it's really good to be back here again. I don't know about all you other folk there. You probably are same thinking the same as me, that it's been a very, very useful experience to be able to get together so easily. And we've had some really good chats and discussions, whatever. And I just really want to put my positive there. It's been excellent for me. So to get to grips with the topic I've chosen here, the urban-rural divide, I feel it's really essential to recognise the relevance of considering from a global perspective. It, worldwide, are so many different situations which need specific solutions. There's an incredible amount of diversity. And when all nations are taken into account, the UK and other so-called developed nations aren't typical world examples, because the populations of the less developed nations overall have a significantly larger percentage of the global population living in rural areas. Now, I haven't done any specific research on this topic. It's just coming from my long-term interest in the subject, and over a period of time, I've made lots of notes, and they're very diverse, and I had a look through and picked out some of the things that I thought perhaps would be most interesting and useful tonight. So, with regard to urban and rural, I think we can say with reasonable accuracy that where people live largely corresponds to their work situation. I mean, that is, i.e., having to earn a living. So if we have a brief look at what work is for urban and rural populations, that will start us off. In urban areas, there'll be manufacturing, industries of many kinds, retail, hospitals, bureaucracy, leisure facilities, and of course, no end of financial services, much of which we socialists consider superfluous to life in socialism, necessary work because it's tied up solely with money and profit. Rural dwellers, on the other hand, are mostly working directly or indirectly in agriculture. And from a global perspective, because the UK and other countries may have many rural residents who commute to work, but not so in many parts of the world, where numerous farmers feed their families and sell the surplus. I think the point I wanted to make there is that when you're living in a country like the UK, like a lot of European countries, it's perhaps not obvious to see the difference between the rural in your country, where you're living now, and that in so many other parts of the world, where it just isn't anywhere near the same. You know, the other thing about that is, I remember the village that I last lived in the UK, where it was just about in commutable distance to London, and properties got sold to what we would have called outsiders who would commute. And then, of course, the local villagers, as they got old enough to get their own place, there's no way they could afford a place in the village that they were born and brought up in. I'm sure you all know that very well. But of course, in so many parts of the world, it just isn't like that at all. The people who live in those areas actually work the land. So now, if we come to listing problems and difficulties that are inherent in both living and working environments, I think the list could be really, really long. But I'll just go into the edges of it, if you like. You'll all have other ideas for this, I'm sure. As for urban dwellers, their air is frequently highly polluted. There's much noise and constant light pollution, often cramped living conditions, slums even, poor infrastructure, water problems, lack of good outdoor space, etc., etc. Working conditions will vary enormously. There's little doubt that the majority of workers have plenty to be unhappy about, whether transport facilities, time taken to and from work, and especially what seems to be ever shrinking of terms, conditions and rates of pay, which cause an awful lot of anxiety about unemployment and possible homelessness. When it comes to rural population and workers, I believe one problem that is most cited is that of shortage of money. Whether it's a Western farmer in hot to the bank because his income is constantly less than his outgoings, I've just got a note here about that. I read recently in the UK, Reef Family Farms, in the Private Eye, June edition, about a third of family farms in the UK rely on tax credits or universal credit, as opposed to large landowners who can collect millions from the EU basic payment scheme, something like £90 an acre, and they have thousands of them. So you all understand that already, I'm sure. Now, let's see, where was I? So shortage of money, where the Western farmer's in hot to the bank because his income is constantly less than his outgoings. Small farmers on most continents at risk of losing their land to foreign multinationals, which are keen to expand monocrops wherever they can, or from mega dams, which flood vast areas of good agricultural land, putting people off their, not only their homes, but also their livelihood. And the problems are increasing on many continents now of the multinationals, whether it's for, it doesn't really matter. There's so many crops that are monocrops that they're only there not to feed people in a direct way, but in an indirect way by being additives to all kinds of processed foods. So although declining, there are still around 70% of the global agricultural products are actually grown on small farms. And many of those are grown organically and from saved seeds. It seems amazing number, but that is factual. While the produce from the monocrops of the big corporations are about profits, from chemically and biologically contaminated crops, I think that is a big difference for many people. Now, apart from the increasing numbers of big businesses which are involved in the rape and pillage of farmland globally, also international institutions such as the IMF, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, they push their monetary policies to their own advantage. After all, in capitalism, farming is just another industry to be used for profit. I mentioned a little earlier that which socialists recognise as one obvious change to be experienced when we reach socialism, that is, non-productive work will disappear. Well, this presumably will also change the ratio of urban to rural populations. I can't really quite imagine how that will work, but it has to be. I don't think there's any doubt that that will have to change, whether it's living, working, or living and working together. But I think that's going to be a very, very big difference in great parts of the world. I'm actually raising this point here because it's this very serious thing, isn't it, that the world is facing the prospect now and continuously, as far as we can see, of impossible living conditions facing billions of people. People who have and will have no choice about leaving their own areas simply to survive. Now, whether this is from things like prolonged drought, that would especially be for agricultural areas, or gradual inundation of great areas of land, again, that would be for urban and rural. I mean, for the rural areas, that the or mega cities, for instance, so many of these mega cities are on very low ground, close to the sea, have big river inlets, and are already, and Bangladesh is already being inundated on a very, almost constant time period. But so megacities and millions of acres of agricultural land will be unavailable for living and or for working. So with consideration given to the three absolute necessities for a human to stay alive, the absolute necessities in the order of the most important: air, water, and food. Nobody can deny that. Nobody can live for very long without air, water, or food. It would be minutes, days, or a few weeks maximum for the food one. But of course, to be a bit ironical here, we could say that in a capitalist system, we should add one more that's absolutely absolutely necessary to survive, and that's money, which we know that so many people in the world are without or in dire need of. I want to focus on the air, water, and food thing, really, and just let it pass through your mind what you think, knowing that, which workers are most necessary for us as a whole. You can get into that, I hope, with me later. You're going to find that what I've got to say here tonight is very short, because what I'm trying to do really is to stimulate some answers to questions that I want to give you. It's just four questions, and then I really would like you to get to grips with the few points that I've raised here and see if we can somehow come to some kind of, consensus of how we feel about what's coming for us, if and when we get to our socialism, our socialist world, as it is, or if the world itself is going to be too difficult for all kinds of things. So the questions that I'd like us to ask ourselves, I hope you will be willing to share some answers here. The first one is, what would be the things that we would want to change in both urban and rural environments for our socialist system, our socialist world? What would we want to change in both urban and rural environments? And the next one is, recognizing the challenges facing the planet for all societies, whatever their political stance, how would populations choose to continue? I'm going to say it again. Recognizing the challenges facing the planet for all societies, whatever their political stance, how would populations choose to continue? And then, what will the future for technology simplify the great change that we might seek? What will be the future for technology to simplify the great changes we might seek? And the last one is, much of current work would be superfluous in socialism, so how do we see populations adapting to that? Much of current work would be superfluous in socialism, so how do we see populations adapting to that? Now, I actually haven't got anything more I want to say. My whole point really has been to involve people as soon as you want to get involved, and as thoroughly and deeply as you would like to address this situation. And I do hope that you are going to join in with that now. Thank you.
Okay.
Could we just ask, please, Carla, or through Carla, could we have your questions on the speaking queue, Janet? Because you've just asked four, and I've forgotten the first two.
Oh, yes, yes, please, yes, I will do that. Yes, yes. Okay, I'll get busy with it right now.
Okay, and in can I take a question, Janet?
Yes.
Okay, I'll take Brian then.
Right. Biggest problem I see in both respects of the rural and the urban is the lack of housing. In the urban, we've got massive shanty towns or very degraded housing property as well, especially on the edges. You'll see it and in the centres of some cities. And then when we look at the rural, as you mentioned, there's a lack of housing for the rural working population. That will have to certainly change within socialism. I think the first thing to be tackled is the shanty towns, and to get them sorted as quickly as possible and put up suitable accommodation outside of the city, right? And try and make a bridge between the city and the rural with the development of these shanty towns, or not shanty towns, of this new accommodation.
I think you're right, Brian. The interesting thing is that so many millions of people around the world on different continents have actually come from the rural areas, been forced from the rural areas into the towns in the hope of making some money. They often live in huge, incredibly cramped conditions, just doing anything they can to, they'll be in the, what they call it, the black economy. They won't be in the economy where they get a job and get paid by the week or the month. They'll be out doing whatever it is, whether it's going through garbage to try and make a few cents, a few pennies or whatever. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And a lot of those people went there not of their own choice, but because they were forced to.
Paul, are you there now? Paul?
Yeah, oh, cheers, thanks.
Are you
thanks,
there? Paul. Right.
Yes, thanks a lot for that. Sorry, I don't know, something went a bit pear-shaped. No, that was excellent, Janet, and it's surprisingly topical in the moment here where I'm in Scotland, in Kilmarnock, which is obviously only about 30 miles west of Glasgow. However, the further you go north, more kind of dire things become for those living out in the sticks, shall we say. As regards the Highlands and Islands, anything north of kind of Oban just now, if you want anything delivered, then you can bet your bottom dollar that you're going to have to expect to pay more by a courier, any courier is willing to go that far. The Scottish Government at the moment are trying to pass legislation to prevent that from happening, because there are some couriers either refusing to deliver goods, commodities or whatever beyond a certain distance, and those who do are charging exorbitant rates. And then, of course, you've got other issues like just being linked into broadband network and getting your daily food shop and things. There are fuel costs, for example. The further north you go, the more expensive these things become. There's definitely an issue there for people living further north. And, of course, as with most problems like that, take it back to its very root cause. And without capitalism, those issues would be driven away overnight. And I think, speaking in terms of density of people, you know, whenever I visit London, you know, it's a lovely place, nice place it is to visit. Those living there would be absolutely soul-destroying, you know, pushing and the shoving and all the rest of it. You know, for people, if people could be spread out a bit more, as I'm sure people would when they're not forced to have to commute into the major cities, you know, and we get the opportunity to spread out a bit more into the countryside in a manageable sort of way, I think that will create a lot more happiness and contentment. And you know, obviously things are worse in other parts of the country. I had the pleasure of visiting India a few years ago, and you know, the rural communities there are just absolutely poverty stricken, and that's the same in many other countries. But yeah, there are definitely issues there to be had and resolved within socialism, the likes of which I've just described. Thanks for that, Janet. That was an excellent talk, really. Thoroughly enjoyed that. Well, brilliant as always. Cheers.
Thank you. I'm just really hoping for everybody to be involved. That's my idea here. I think you said India, didn't you? Quick calculation, I think population of India is more than 20 times that of the UK. That was a quick mental arithmetic thing I had there. Oh, Alan wants to say something here.
Yeah, just recognising that in a lot of rural populations around the world, people sometimes, you know, here in Turkey, we have neighbours who are money poor but land rich. So they're able to produce food. They don't have a lot of disposable income. It's so very different.
Thanks, Carla. Just to make a comment on your third question, Janet, what will be the future for technology? Of course, we had the weekend school on this, didn't we? We had several very interesting talks about how socialism might use technology, and I think several people expressed the view that you know, the more things changing in capitalism technologically, the better, because it prevents opportunities to actually do things more effectively within socialism. The fact that most technology in capitalism is so perverted to the ends of profit shouldn't make us sort of reject the idea of technology as such. Just to sort of mention a book which I read several years ago called News from Gardenia by Robert Llewellyn. It was a new take, unsurprisingly, on News from Nowhere. I read it, should have reviewed it for the Standard. I apologise for not having done so, because it's the kind of book that could that would have fitted very well on the reviews pages. But anyway, in News from Gardenia, it's a socialist world. It's a world without money, without buying and selling. And a lot of it's very rural, but this is underpinned by the most advanced technology imaginable. So one example of this is that if you wish to travel from the Western world to the Eastern world, there are the means of transport for doing so and getting you there in about 15 minutes. Now, this seems sort of ridiculous and impossible, but it's actually made very plausible in this book, by the way it's explained. And after all, you know, who would have thought 30, 40 years ago that we could actually have this discussion tonight with people from all over Britain, from Turkey, and as happened at the weekend, from New Zealand. So just about anything's possible, isn't it? And probably the less we can imagine it, the more it may be possible.
Yes, yeah, it is. I'm sorry that unfortunately I had to miss that session on Sunday. I was in on Friday and Saturday, but missed that one. So I knew there would have been some very interesting stuff there. But if anybody else can put in anything more from there, which fits in with what we're talking about with the, especially the urban-rural divide. And I also would like to point out again, within that, there's no doubt that the planet is going to be going through some of the more difficult things that we can imagine in the very near future. It's coming closer and closer wherever we live. I know already what I hear about people talking about the weather that you've had in the UK recently in the last few years, actually, how much is changing, getting hot, whatever the wet, but how different it is in different parts of the world, where there's a great concern that of millions of people, millions having to move from where they are, and where are they going to go? I mean, at the moment, what choices do they have in capitalism anyway? The only choice they have is what they've done before, is to move to the edge of towns, which are getting bigger and bigger and bigger, in the hope of just trying to make enough so that they can eat. And I'm just wondering how we can see any of that being helped in a positive way with anything that we would be looking for in socialism.
Thanks, Janet. I'd like to pop in here. I've recently spent a couple of weeks in Italy, a little town, and basically it was idyllic except for no sodding transport. You know, unless you've got your own car, you can't get anywhere, to be quite honest. So what I'd like to see for question one would probably be much more transport and availability to move places within the countryside, and less traffic in the cities. And I'd like for the cities, if we still want cities, for there to be much more green space. So therefore, what I'd like to see would be a kind of redistribution, the rural areas getting a little bit more like the towns, and the cities getting a little bit more like the countryside.
Carla, will you give, you know, can I cut in here on this exact point? Is that okay?
But you know,
I'll let you.
Thank you. Because it is relevant. I mean, many years ago, Janet and I went on a cycling holiday in Holland. And that was an incredible experience, because the what we found was that, for example, between the major urban centres, you had trains. Trains travel between the major urban centres. When the train stopped at a station, any station along the route, the coaches, the buses, were waiting there. People had been bussed in to pick up the train at the time that it stopped, and the buses picked up the people from the train who wanted to get off and took them to the rural areas, you know, their villages and what have you. The amazing thing is that I bet nobody can guess who designed this integrated transport system. I'm going to tell you, it was British transport engineers after the war. Thank you.
Oh, it's possible.
Mike?
Hello there. Yeah, thanks for the talk. Yeah, it was really interesting, and yeah, lots to think about coming from it. Yeah, trying to get the imagination working. But on your point, question three, what will be the future for technology to simplify the great changes we might seek? Well, in some ways, places aren't as cut off as they used to be now, and that will continue into the future. You know. Obviously, once you've got the setup, you know, email, you know, social media, that's sort of non-geographic in a way, and it can be picked up by anyone, no matter if they're, you know, fairly remote or in a more built-up area. And of course, in the future as well, you know, drones could, you know, deliver, you know, necessary supplies to more remote places, or 3D printers could be in places to, you know, print off something that's needed rather than having to sort of physically transport it. And yeah, on the one hand, that sounds great. But on the downside, some people might want to choose to be a bit more cut off, a bit more remote. And, you know, they'd have the freedom to do that. You know, they wouldn't have the economic sort of handcuffs that they might have now. So, yeah, although technology would in some ways cut down the divide between, you know, more built up areas where, you know, everything's physically there, not too far away from you, and more rural areas where they're not. Yeah, technology can help bridge that gap. But yeah, that's not necessarily a good thing for everyone, in that some people, as I say, might not want everything on tap. They might want to sort of go off radar, and, you know, that would be perfectly fine. So yeah, that was just my two penneth worth. Thank you.
Yeah, can I? That's fine. Thanks, Mike. I do get your point, and yeah, I do go along with it to a great degree. I just want to try and bring this point home again of if I can keep my thread. It's looking at I want us to look outward from what we used to. What we used to in the UK, and try and think about the different effects on people, like say in some of the South American countries, which are high in the mountains and not near any big towns or whatever like that, or same in India, where you've got some really massive towns overwhelmed with people, but then you've got the greater area, which is people spread out in forests as well as in agricultural areas, again mountainous areas there too. It's trying to spread the thinking to socialism has to be a global system. How do we think about, okay, if it comes to it, presumably they've got their ideas about how they do it in their local areas. But I also still think that I really do believe that we should also be very aware of it.
Thank you, Janet. Brian?
Yeah. Question number four, much of the current work would be superfluous in socialism, so how do we see population adapting? Well, a number of things would change during the revolutionary process. I mean, a lot of attitudes would either be adapting or changing as well. The first is the realization coming through is that to be able to choose our occupation, what we do, and how long we do it for. You know, that'll take a hell of a lot to get used to for some people, especially them that's been stuck in their work for, you know, same kind of work for years and years. Like, the other one, attitude that we've got to come to terms with is to share a hell of a lot more, and not just food, you know, but also your experiences and your education, etc. You know, and the sharing of accommodation. So, willing, if you're already living in a large house, say with three or four bedrooms, and it's just yourself, willing to turn around and say, right, do I can have somebody in here, you know. That you know, both of us get along with. But most importantly, the attitude that we will have to adapt to is a caretaking attitude, that we are specifically when it comes to the production of food. Now, presently, the caretakers are the farmers, right, and they may be tenant farmers, and they may be owners of the land, etc. They suspect that they are going to find very big hurdles, right, when it comes to sharing what they've already got. And, you know, they will be adamant, you know, a lot of them will be adamant to turn around saying, you know, that we are caretakers now, and we are looking after the land the best we can. And with the capitalist environment gone, you know, we can look after it a lot better, and we don't need to, you know, to share farming or occupation, etc. You know, And we know that that's exactly what they'll have to do. They'll have to share. It is pointless keeping things to yourself, because all you're doing is having a de facto reality of private ownership still prevailing in the socialist environment. So that's how I see things, having to change. You know, it's choosing the occupation, a sharing attitude, and a caretaker attitude.
Yeah, that makes such a lot of sense, Brian. But within that, do you not feel that, say, farmers there would have so many more people able to work on the farm, do what's required? And Alan's just said in my ear, and learn about it as well. It could take off so much of the pressure, because, you know, currently, I know the UK, they have incredible pressure on them. The suicide rate's going up enormously. Like I said earlier, they're in hot to banks or what have you. They just, you know, the small farmers actually don't get much of the relief from the whatever the fund is called that, you know, the big farmers get enormous amounts from. But I would have thought, like with all kinds of other sort of industries, you could have more people involved in the work with those, so that actually everybody's working less anyway. Do you feel that that's on the cards?
That is definitely on the cards, but it's going to take time.
Yes.
I mean, anybody that's worked for a farmer will certainly understand the mindset. The mindset is purely self-interest. That's all they're concerned about. So all they're concerned about is occupying the farmhouse and the land and producing things, hopefully, for a profit. So, you know, for them to get used to the idea that they're no longer purely the only caretakers, right, and also that they've got to share what they probably got, and willing for people to share with them as well their experiences, right, it's going to take time. I doubt very much that we'll find many farmers coming forward as socialists, to be quite honest with you. But that's my attitude. You know, I could well be wrong.
What about the fact that when their machinery needs repair, it's going to be done for free? And, you know, any pickers that are required, they're going to come for free. When it's haymaking time, there's going to be people around for free. He's not going to have to pay any labourers. Say he. I suppose we've got some women farmers as well. But I'm just sort of trying to think outside the box there. Communities, communal work. And as it's going, anyway, which will be happening in all kinds of other areas of work as well. Anybody who actually owns a business now won't own a business with socialism, will they? So, tough if they don't like it.
Paddy?
Hi, it's a shame that, Janet, you couldn't make it on the Sunday, because some of the questions that you've asked, they were a bit covered by the talk I gave on Sunday, which I don't want to rehearse.
Sorry, Paddy, you're pretty quiet, Paddy.
I'm pretty quiet, am I?
Made a change.
Hold on a minute.
Maybe it's just me, I don't know.
No, it's not just you, Howard.
Is that any better?
A little, Paddy.
A bit, yeah, a bit.
Okay, that's really strange. I don't know why that is. Okay. Yeah. Right. Sorry, that's put me off my stroke. On the question of how populations would adapt in the future, I mean, I've just checked now, and the UN says that 55% of the world population is urbanised today, but that's expected to rise to 68% in the next 30 years. So you can see this massive global urbanisation process. And clearly all of this is driven by the need to get work. You know, there's no real question about that. Socialism will break that connection between city and work, I think. And what you'll probably see is a reversal of, you'll see de-urbanisation. What you'll see is, I think, people spreading out, and the urban environment and the rural environment sort of overlapping and then become, and then kind of merging, so that you'll get, you know, cities in rural areas, towns in rural areas, and gardens in cities, that kind of thing. I don't think to answer Howard's point, his novel where people can cross the world in 15 minutes. I think there are actually physical limits to how fast you can go. I think you probably could build something that could get you across the world in 15 minutes, but you would be crushed into tomato paste by the G forces. Similarly, there are limits to what socialism can do, and sometimes we get a bit carried away with what we think socialism can do, and so you see people think, they'll, in their haste to criticise everything, every failure of capitalism, they automatically assume that it'll all be wonderful in socialism. I'll give you an example. Somebody mentioned supermarkets delivering to rural areas, and some government is thinking about legislating, I can't remember who it was, to keep those rural deliveries going. Well, supermarkets are losing a fortune on home deliveries to rural areas, but they can't stop now because, well, partly because of government interventions like this, but also because people now treat it as a right, whereas a few years ago there were no deliveries at all. In socialism, I don't think it's necessarily the case that people can just live wherever they want if they then expect good transport connections and good access to food and facilities. I think that's unreasonable, and I think that you're going to find that if you want to go and live off the beaten track, that's fine, but you can't very well demand the right to have a perfect bus service running night and day, and perfect and train lines and accessible services. I think that's unreasonable, and also from the carbon impact point of view, it's not really feasible. But I think that's just a note of caution, because I think sometimes we do run away with ourselves and think that it'll all be great in socialism. It won't. It'll be a set of compromises, and there'll be compromises to do with where you can live, even though you're not. You don't have to work. You don't have to be near a city to work. I think you'd still want to be near available services. So you can't just go and disappear into the wilds and then expect the services to follow you.
Yeah, good points. And you mentioned carbon emissions, whatever. And I think that's another point with all of it we're talking about here, has to be recognised, doesn't it? Because we want to see a lot of changes, an enormous amount of changes, but we also still have to recognise the fact of the way the way the world is going. So some resources are limited, and I know it depends on how you use the resources, use them for things that are important rather than just any old thing to make money. And emissions is the other thing that you mentioned. With any new ideas, it's going to be balancing the negatives and the positives and negatives, because we don't want to continue to make things worse. We must be committed to make things better, surely.
I'm assuming it's Alan wants to come in now because Janet doesn't need an invite.
Yes.
So it's you, Alan, is it?
Thank you. Yes, it is. Yeah, it's a couple of points covering what Paddy was talking about, and also Brian. Regards Paddy, I see populations being far more mobile than they are today. I mean, they're pretty mobile now, but I see them being mobile for the good reasons that essential work needs to be done for communities and societies, so people will move and move around and be able to do that. And going back to the farming thing, I know I go on interminably about our experiences here in Turkey and our neighbours. You know, we live in rural communities, and you know, our neighbours are all subsistence farmers. They may have occasional jobs elsewhere, driving a minibus or working in tourism or whatever. And what we've noticed over the last 20 plus years is how the younger generation are so, because of the system, are lured away from the village and the essential work. The most essential work. The most essential people in the world are farmers and fishermen, people who produce food in a sustainable way. And the young people are being lured away by the very nature of the system, so that what we see more and more. It's old people. I mean, sometimes very old people, who are going out and tending their goats and tending their fields and struggling to make ends meet, knowing that their children, not their children so much, their grandchildren, are walking away from it, walking away from this essential production process of the small farmer, the most productive people in the world, far beyond, you know, the proponents of industrial farming and Monsanto and God knows what else. The most productive people are the small farmers. They produce the majority of the food that the world needs to survive and to live. And I just see that in socialism, many of us will return back to the land, to the husbandry of the land, to the care of the land, which is so important. And that's not a retrograde step. It's not a walking away from technology. Technology will still be there. Technology will be there to be used to our advantage. But the bottom line is we need to do the thing which for generations, for millennia, has been so important, which is to nurture the very land and the environment on which we depend. That's my point. It's farmers, fishermen, and people who produce food and who care for the environment and the land are the most important people, not socialists, not anybody else. The people who care for the very soil and the very atmosphere upon which we depend are the most important people in the world. You know, that's the point I wanted to make. Thank you.
Well, Janet, do you want to answer your old man?
You know that I pretty much agree with what he's saying. You know, we're very much on the same page as far as that goes. So, yeah.
Okay. Mike.
Hello again. Yeah, I think this might sort of back up what Alan's just said. It's on question four. Much of the current work would be superfluous in socialism. So how do you see populations adapting? And, you know, there's the assumption that individuals wouldn't need to sort of work as much in a socialist society, wouldn't be sort of slaves to the, 40-hour week. Either because of technology or because as the question poses, we won't need sort of banks or insurance or all of those other industries. So yeah, people have a lot more spare time. So what are they going to do with that time? And if they're not glued in front of if they're not glued to a screen, they're going to be out and about. And I think maybe socialists in previous generations would say that, yeah, there'd be a lot of, you know, travelling around. But maybe now that we're a bit more environmentally aware, you know, that might not be environmentally sustainable for, you know, a lot of the population to sort of jet set all over the world on a whim, not unless, I don't know, teleports are invented by then. So I think there'll be a lot more sort of local involvement. And this sort of harks back to Alan's point in that, you know, we'll have a lot more spare time in our own communities. I spend very little time where I live because I drive off to work or, you know, and then in the evenings I'm often inside. So I don't have much to do with my local community. So I think in a socialist society, there'll be much more sort of local awareness. And of course, that will impact on the urban rural split because, yeah, you know, individual areas will be able to sort of develop their own sort of way of doing things because there'll be people focused much more on the area where they live than in capitalism. So, yeah, I think that might mean that there's greater diversity of cultures, communities, you know, each with their own little, you know, hobbies, if you like, which turn into, you know, sort of little cottage industries. So, yeah, I think there'll be much more focusing on the local in a socialist society.
Yeah, I think you're right, absolutely. And for communities, things could only get better. Where people, like you say, people will have some more time. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And they were making their own decisions collectively about what they're going to do about their area, for instance. And that would be also like for the spare time activities, whatever, for children and young adults and old folk, whoever. I don't think there's any doubt about that. It can only improve people's quality of life. That's how I feel. It doesn't mean that you have to have more things at all, but you will have the choices to be involved in different things, which is more difficult in the system that we have now.
Malcolm.
Hello. This is about the first question about urbanisation and that. I put up a photo in the useful link. It's actually a photo of Singapore. It's a tree garden or something. I don't know if anybody's looked at it, but I think cities would become greener. And that photo I put up, you could actually, it'd be quite easy to grow your own food. I mean, with people talking about local stuff as well. I think you'd get a lot more people growing food in urban environments as well. You know, but kind of the urban environment become more countryside, and countryside would probably become a bit more urban as well. And as engineering works and whatever.
Look, Malcolm, where did you say you put the photograph?
In the useful links.
In the useful links. Has anybody found that yet? We're looking now to see what it is.
Yeah, it's there. Yeah, nice photo.
Haven't found it yet. Anybody else?
Bottom of the text channels.
Ah, yeah.
I've just put it in the speaking queue.
Oh, well done, Steve.
Okay, put back at least. I'll get it back there.
Very pretty.
Can I? Oh, yes. Now, Malcolm, would you mind now, now we see it, tell us the point you made again, please.
I'm kind of making a point that it's no longer, I mean, in socialism, urbanisation is a feature of capitalism. Basically, you've got people come here to find and work, but if they're going to big cities, you could have them more like that, I suppose there will be big cities still, but it obviously become greener. You'd grow your own food in it, you'd have parks in it. And just sort of, I think it's lovely looking, obviously. And they're kind of, I mean, that's a high rise. I don't think I'd end up actually lives in that, but certainly something. I'm sure we could manage it in socialism.
making our environment more beautiful, something that we can enjoy. And
yeah, there's that aspect to it as well. But, sort of, I mean, some that is a pretty ugly urban environment too, but the aspect that you could grow, you should grow foodstuffs and grow whatever you wanted to grow in it as well. I thought that would be pretty fine, obviously.